Session number 15736, Ernie Tompkins, Reel 5.
Mr. Tompkins, Reel 5. Now, we were discussing why you wouldn't attack, even though there were three of you, attack one German reconnaissance machine. And you were making a very good point that you had a job to do. You were supporting the Navy, other reconnaissance machines were supporting the Army. Could you just enlarge on that a bit?
Well, yes. Now, supposing the Germans not going to wait for you, naturally, that you want to get away. Whether you brought him down at the finish didn't matter. The thing is, he would be drawing you away from your job. You would still have to be somewhere near your position, keeping your eye out for shipping and that sort of thing, see. You can't go chasing around the sky after a single German. You've got to, as I say, keep to your job. But it never dawned on us about, well, I was there anyway, combat.
Did you know or hear much about the so-called aces? People like, well, McCudden was dead and Manock, but Bishop, people like that. Had you heard of them?
Yeah, but not a lot. I could tell you a bit about Warnford. Do you remember Warnford?
I've heard of him. Could you tell me about him?
Yes, I can tell you. Now, Warnford, I think he was number one squadron. He wasn't in our squadron, but they all knew him. Now, Warnford was an ordinary pilot, nothing very special about it. He was flying over Gaunt, round about Gaunt, where I've been talking about, and he found himself over the top of a German Zeppelin. He had 6 Cooper 20-pound bombs. I think it was the last one that got this Zepp. And the result of that was, as you know, he got the VC. Now, Warnford, unfortunately, he got to his head a bit. He got his VC. He went to, I forget the name of the aerodrome now, he went to another aerodrome. And there was a newspaper chap, a reporter or something or other. He was after stories, you know. And Warnford took him up, and that's the last thing he did. They crashed, and Warnford was killed. They don't tell you that in the paper, but that's what happened. But Warnford, unfortunately, I think it got to his head a bit. Whether he started trying to fool around with this machine, because he only had an old string bag thing, you know. But we didn't get any decorations in our squadron.
Now,
didn't hear anything about decorations in those days.
So when you'd done your mission, you'd fly back and land. That was it. Was landing, I mean, you were good, you say you were good at landing.
Yeah, I was, but funny you should mention it. What were you going to say? Do you land in formation?
That's about it, yes.
Yeah, all right. I'm glad you mentioned it. I wasn't told. We took off in formation. When we landed, I landed in formation. I don't know what Bladen was doing, but I was keeping close to my commander, and I got bogged down. I started a taxi, and the thing sank down in the mud. So the CO said, you should have been told. He said, go around and have a look and see what you were trying to land on. He said, we don't land in formation here. He said, we can't, haven't got the width of the aerodrome to do that. Not precisely, you know. It's all right taking off. You can pick your exact spot. But land is another matter. So they didn't reckon to land in formation. So I got bogged down a bit. Didn't do any damage, just flopped over.
Went over on its nose?
I had a photograph of it. They should have told me, he said, they should have told me not to land down there. I didn't know it was any. This is the first flight. I didn't know it was a muddy, boggy ground.
That was on your very first flight?
That was my first flight, yes.
Did you break the... Would that break the propeller going over?
No. I stopped the propeller. I didn't do any damage, but it just sank down in the mud, see?
Oh, I see. You didn't actually tip onto your nose.
No.
Now, there's something else I wanted to ask over here about when you were a destroyer escort. Now, that is unusual. Escorting destroyers. Could you tell me what that mission was? That was your first noticed, I think, on the 19th of October, and you were up for about 55 minutes doing that.
Yes. Now, the idea was, you see, the destroyers, they pick a lousy day, which it was. Not very good visibility. And they would send us a signal. They wanted cover for these destroyers. A couple of destroyers. And there was Biles and Blade and myself, the usual three, see. We were detailed to give them cover. So we had to sit on top of these destroyers while they poked their noses into the harbour and shot away, you know. And then, of course, we saw them away and we came on. It was only away about less than an hour, I believe, wasn't it? Something like that.
55 minutes.
It wasn't far away, see. As soon as they got clear, well, we left them to it. It was to stop German fighters coming, you see, because Gistels wasn't all that far away from Ostend. If you know to get the map, you'll find Gistels, it wasn't far. So if they knew there was a raid coming on and they give Gistels warning enough, they'd be there to receive us, you know. But fortunately, we'd done the job and left. I was lucky to be picked for that. Well, lucky or unlucky, I don't know.
Did you come under much fire from the ground?
I did in that case, yes. Plenty of machine gun fire, see. And I had a few bullets in the plane, in the wings. Fortunately, if you don't get one in the tank and yourself, well, you've got a chance. If you get one in the tank, especially a tracer, you're going to meet trouble. Much of it, too.
Did fire, because you didn't have parachutes, did you?
No, we had no parachutes.
Did the idea of the plane catching fire, did that worry you? Because I know it worried some pilots.
Now, when I was up at Wittering, as a photograph, I believe it's up there, I got a photograph, looking in the a Harrier. You know, the Harrier, see? And the group Captain Morris was the other side showing me. And I went, he said, the parachute harness. Oh, I said, that's a luxury we didn't have. What? You didn't have a parachute? I said, no, we didn't have a parachute. He said, what can you do? Oh, I said, we had one of three options, I said. He said, what's that? Well, I said, the petrol tank is between the pilot and the observer. I said, if you like to stay there, you could get roasted beautifully, you know. I said, or you could jump out. Chance was at the end. You wouldn't get away with it, don't they? I said, we had a pistol, we could blow our brains out. So you had plenty of chances, like, you know. He laughed about that. He said, God, blimey. And they were called it the Flaming Coffin, you know, the DH-4. The Yanks called it Flaming Coffin.
That's because of where the tank was.
The tank was between the pilot and the observer, see. There were 65 gallons of it.
What would you have done? Did you think about it?
Never did think about it, you know. It couldn't happen to us, you know, that's the idea, see. Oh, that couldn't happen to us. It happened to some people. I never had any crashes, as a matter of fact.
So it didn't worry you?
Didn't worry us at all.
What about Archie, anti-aircraft fire? Did you get much of that?
That, no, we more or less ignored that. But I will tell you this, and it's common. It's not only me. Especially when we first started flying, you had the butterflies, sort of an emptiness in your stomach. It's not wind up or anything like that. You're not scared or anything like that. it's the excitement of it, I think. And directly you sat in that machine, got going, it vanished. You became part of the machine. You lost all that.
But, so you still had that, even when you were flying a DH-4?
Right up to the end, almost. You know, as long as I was flying DH-4s, I used to get this bit of butterflies. And I wasn't windy. And other chaps used to say the same thing.
Were there any pilots in the squadron whose nerve had gone?
I don't know how long they were kept there, Peter, but if you know what, I got the photograph there. There was 13 captains in my squadron in the march. And by the time I got there, it was 3 or 4, you know, had been weeded right out. But I don't know what the stint would be. But with our job, I should think, if you did a couple of months, you were doing pretty well.
So, but was there anybody there while you were there who was a bit nervy, you would say, or scared, or whose nerve had gone?
I tell the truth, I don't think they showed it, but the thing is, yeah, I was only in contact with my own flight, and I think they were pretty good class there. But
that was, now, let me ask you about, that was Byers and Bladen, wasn't it? In your flight?
I think Captain Bryant, that's it. Captain Biles.
Biles?
And Bladen.
What were they like as people?
I never get Captain Biles. I'll tell you a story about him. Better not let this go through, though.
What's that, then?
Well, I'll tell you. He was a jocular sort of chap. I liked him. We seemed to take to each other, you know. I'll never forget him. We had a gent's place just outside the mess, extension they put on, you know, and it was dark. And we were stood in this place. You couldn't let this go through.
It's all right, carry on. Yep.
So we were stood in this place, and it's dark, see, so you couldn't sort of get drunk, but he had quite a drop, you know. You didn't have to show any ill effects in the morning. He said, Tom, he said, is my cock out? I said, should it be? Is it long enough? He said, he grunted at that. He said, it should be. He said, I'm piddling, he said. I don't forget Buzz, he said that. I'm piddling, he said.
What about Bladen? What was he like?
Oh, Bladen was, I got his photograph. He was a nice fella. We sort of talked to each other.
Can I just ask you about some of the others? What Captain Bailey was the A flight commander. What about Captain Robinson, the C flight commander?
Yeah, he was a sort of quiet sort of fella, you know, genuine sort of chap, but I never see a smile on his face or anything like that. He was a quite nice fella. Of course, they were what they call the escort flight, you see.
What was your flight? What was A flight called, then?
That was a photography flight, look. They used to use the photographers, and we were what they call the WT flight, wireless telegraphy flight, shoots and that sort of thing.
With Captain Biles?
Now, Captain Biles... what would you say about Captain Bell?
It says on your picture that he was B flight commander.
Yes, that's right.
What was he? That's Captain Biles and Captain Bailey. I'm getting them a bit mixed up.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Captain Bailey was A flight.
Right.
He was on the camera flight.
What was Major Gow like? The CO?
A very nice fella. Unfortunately, he had a bit of leg trouble. But he was genuine, you know. Never showed any real excitement, but he was quite a friendly fella. He was very popular.
What about Pendred?
Of course, I got his records, Pendred. Why it was, I don't know. But you take the equation, the electric equation. Unlike poles, attract. Like poles repel. Now Pendred seemed to have got attracted to me. Then there was Cowper. He was a son of the big brewers in London. had a chap named I was friendly with, a chap named Maffey. He worked at Derry and Tom's up in Kensington. But there was money there. I think Pendry's people were pretty well off. And there was at the finish, we had a couple of Canadians there.
Parker,
he was a Canadian. And just trying to think of the other names, man.
Bladen?
No.
Gore, the ground officer.
Gore, he was a ground engineer. I forget that. Anyway, it was two Canadians. I think the other chap, Parker was my the roommate. You saw the picture of my cabin, didn't you?
Now tell me about, I wanted to ask, where did you live? Well, could you give me a picture of where you lived and, a word description of where you lived and what the facilities were like at the hangar and things?
Oh, I see. Yes.
At Berg.
The Germans at Berg, that was out in the open, they were just ordinary huts. I wasn't there very long, see. We moved up to, when I say, yes, I was there a month or two.
So you were at Berg's throughout the war?
That's right, yes.
And what was the setup there? You were in huts, were you?
In huts, yes, something like 30 men army huts. That's all we had there. But when we moved up to Farson there, of course, our headquarters was a farmhouse.
Right, I'll come back to that, because that's after the end of the war. Right. Now, anything else then about these missions you went on? I find it very difficult to read some of these. Do you remember any other jobs you had?
I had the main jobs was, of course, the Gaunt Patrol. That was an essential, that was a regular thing. I did the Dutch patrol.
What was that?
That was a long one. That was about 3 hours and a half, wasn't it?
3 hours, 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, what was the Dutch patrol?
Well, we go right up to a place called... It's very funny. It's spelled Y-M-U-I-D-E-N. We just called it Muiden. I was talking to a Dutch person when I was down at Rustington, and she said it's... Meeden, as they call it, see, and that's a port right on up on the Dutch coast that we used to go down the spot for any German shipping and that sort of thing. That was a long one.
Did you ever see any German shipping?
No, I can't remember seeing any particular German shipping. There might have been, but I wouldn't have noticed them, of course.
Did you fly along the coast, or would you go out to sea?
As a point, we flew normally just inside. We didn't fly actually on the coast, 2 or 3 miles inland. But if you wanted to get away from Germans, you could go out to sea. I don't think they'd follow you very far, not with our D's, of course, but... We didn't just follow the coast, you know. Here's the coast way over here, like, you know, you could... At 10,000 feet, you're rising 70 miles away. So you can see quite a fair way. I should say perhaps we were about 5 or 6 miles inland, and you could see... You could still see a bit of shipping at that, unless the weather was bad.
What was it like that high up, 17,000 feet, in your cockpit?
No, it's a very funny thing. If you got on, if you went up yourself, say 100 feet, say you looked over Clifton Suspension Bridge and looked down, you got that sense of height. Otherwise, you're a little bit scared of the height. But when you get up high, you detach from the earth. And you don't realize that you're so high. You don't feel a bit windy about being up all that height. But as I say, I wasn't fond of even getting up on a house and look down, you know. It gives you more sense of height than if you're right up there 20,000 feet. You're looking at a map. It's just like a map.
What about the noise? What was the noise like when you were up there?
Well, it was a bit noisy. Of course, the Rolls engine was a little bit on the noisy side. Too noisy to talk to anybody like that, or even receive wireless. But
what about now? You were up there, for instance, on the Dutch patrol. You were up there for 3.5 hours. What was the cold like when you were up that long?
Well, there again, I never really felt the cold at any time. We're well protected. And I don't think, perhaps we were getting a little bit of warmth from the engine. But as I say, you sort of realise that if you turned your goggles back, you know, and got a bit of cheek exposure, you'd get a frostbite. But I didn't find the cold too bad at all.
When you were flying like that, did you have to think about what you were doing to stay in formation, or did it just come naturally?
It more or less comes naturally. It's like driving a motor car. I mean, it's you'd think going to 100 miles an hour each other, it was a job to keep formation, but it wasn't. You were like, you're stationary in relation to each other. You didn't realise that you were going all that speed.
How far apart would you be?
Oh, 5 or 6 feet apart. Close as you could get. They never used to worry us, get it tight.
And what speed would you be flying at?
130 perhaps, around about 130 miles an hour.
Now, that isn't that rather faster? There was a point in your other tape I wanted to ask you about. You seem to have flown the DH-4 faster than what people would have thought. You had a special method, didn't you?
That's right.
Now, that has not been recorded. I know you've done it before, but I'd like you to do that again because that's important. Well, how did you get the extra speed?
Well, what happened was this. Now, I've never heard any other squadrons talk about this. I've never heard of it. But, of course, they had to tell me about it. Now, if you wanted to get away from the Germans, I know you could open your engine, perhaps to take off and use every bit of power you've got, but you couldn't last long like that. 2 or 3 minutes, you'd be seized up. So you want to get the extra speed without any extra engine. So you got an incidence wheel, as I said. You wind that incidence wheel, that was on the left-hand side, wind that incidence wheel, and look at your clock. And where we would normally do 130 miles an hour, you wind that down until your clock registers 140 miles an hour. See? Now you're still going down. And then when you get that, you hold it there with your stick. You stop it from going any farther down. Otherwise, it's arm aching, you see, because you've got to hold it there. What you're reducing is incidence, which is your, what they call the active resistance. Because you can imagine, see, the plane, say you're flying like this, like that. If you reduce your incidence, reduce your incidence, that's your active resistance. Well, of course, you're going to go faster with the same engine. But normally, if you let your stick go, you go on diving down, but you're holding it there. And you could do that for 3 or 4 minutes and probably get away from the Germans. I've never heard that mentioned.
And what speed would you usually go at?
Around about 125 to 130, something like that.
So you went at nearly your top speed all the time?
We could go at 140. But I think the speed that they used to reckon a DH-4 would travel would be 133 miles an hour. So we could always... And I'm not talking about full throttle, I'm talking about cruising speed. But 133 miles an hour, well, we could travel along 130 miles an hour, see, quite comfortably.
When you were in formation, would you zigzag about, or would you fly straight?
Straight, absolutely straight. And we didn't have to do any twisting around, unless if there were Germans about, we'd have to do something about it.
Would you be always looking around you to make sure there weren't Germans coming at you? Or would you all do that? Or
of course, you've got, like I said, you've got the observer there. He could be stood up. He's got his machine gun, see. And he would be, he's the man to keep his eye out for Germans, look. And he, like I said, he'd register that by tapping the socket. You'd look up and see what it was.
So the pilot would just be concentrated on flying. He wouldn't be looking around for Germans.
No, not necessarily. You couldn't see so very much. See, the pilot was underneath the planes, look. And you couldn't see a lot. By the way,
what was it like in bad weather?
Well, we had to avoid that, of course. I never did much flying in the rain. If we took off and it was raining, well, we'd get up away from it, see.
So you'd fly above the cloud.
We didn't fly for long in the rain. But like I said, I never had to do much flying in the rain.
Now, three of your trips, particularly on immediately, obviously, the 23rd and 26th of October, you went up to Gaunt. What were you doing there? That is
the other side of Bruges, you see, which is the inland port that we got to keep an eye on. Bruges, that's the main thing. And we used to fly over Gaunt, which wasn't all that distance away. We were trying to turn round at Gaunt.
Now, you said you didn't get much anti-aircraft fire. Was that because you were so high?
Oh, we used to get a fair amount of anti-aircraft fire, but not to the extent we should if we got it down low, of course.
What was it like being under anti-, you know, what could you see?
I remember that all right. You know, you'd be, like when we did that Dutch patrol, it was a beautiful day, everything peace and quiet, then suddenly it was woof, woof, woof. That's exactly how it went, and you would see these shells bursting, you know. I had a few bursts fairly close, but it didn't seem to worry us at all.
Did you take evasive action, or would you just carry flying straight on?
Carry on.
You wouldn't?
Oh, no. Well, it wouldn't be much point, really. You might zigzag into one, let alone get away from it.
Were you aware, in late October, that the end of the war was coming?
Now, according to the report I got, Pendred, he reckons that he went on leave a week before the war finished, see? And he said we knew the end was coming, but we didn't. We were a little bit surprised. I know we had a bit of a trip round Dunkirk, you know, to celebrate. We were a bit surprised when we heard that the armistice had been, at least, the Germans had caved in.
Now, you hadn't done any flying from the 28th of October until the armistice. Why was that? Was there any particular reason? The next flight, you did a flight on the 28th of October.
It might have been, but we didn't know. Of course, there might have been flying done by other people on the squadron, though.
But not you.
I didn't have to do any, no. There might, like you said, they might have known that the Germans were tottering, look. But I didn't have to do any flying, or else I'd have had it down there. I don't know why.
Now, you said your celebration. What do you remember of the celebration in Dunkirk?
When shouting, you went round the town and had a few drinks, that sort of thing. Of course, there was no coppers there to see if you were under the influence or anything like that.